This is Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, awkward, sweet, and tongue-tied, the unromantic hero in speculative fiction.
Ah, so this episode is brought in part because I have spent probably the last few days just ranting at Jules all about characters who fall into this definition.
Yes. that's definitely a part of it. And I think we've kind of had this one brewing for a while because we've almost touched on it with some other episodes, yeah. And then we just decided we're going to bust out an entire episode about it because we've apparently got a lot to say.
A lot of feelings as well kind of stirring up there. And we said, right, let's actually talk about this because, honestly.
Okay. We're going to start by defining what we understand as a romantic hero. So this is not what we're actually going to be talking about.
No, but this is what how you might understand romantic hero.
Yeah, so if you were looking at, you know, if you were genuinely looking at the romance genre as a whole, you'll find the vast body of romantic heroes. They're very stacked. Twirl my moustache. Sorry about that. I'm just going to wait for Madeleine to come back and then I'll start again.
Sorry. Okay, please continue.
Yeah, generally you will find that the romantic hero is good looking, quite athletic usually. Mm-hmm. Later books have definitely gone into men's musculature rather a lot. In fact, you'd probably find that the romantic hero is also male 90% of the time.
Yeah.
And then you're looking at qualities such as a lot of them are kind of dark and brooding and have a dark and brooding past. They're looking for the right woman. They're sort of protective / overbearing. Some of them are very rich as well. That seems to be a big thing, them being really rich.
Being very rich. They're usually very intellectual as well.
In an annoying way.
In a very sort of I know everything kind of way.
A supercilious sort of superior type way. And, you know, they'll have good points as well. And, you know, later romance writers, and we're not just talking about romance, we're talking about anyone who writes romantic subplot. They've added things like, you know, perhaps this one is, you know, he's a little bit of a sweetheart when it comes to children.
Yeah.
Which, you know, that gives me a different kind of shuddersomeness because that's kind of like you've got this dark brooding hero type who's very kind to small children. You're clearly trying to push the idea that he's a potential good father.
Yeah.
Which opens up an entire new can of problems for me. We won't go into that. So anyway, you can, from what we've said, you can probably quite easily picture one or two romantic type heroes.
Yeah, definitely.
These are not the guys that we're talking about today. Yeah, okay. We want to talk about something completely different. But let's, before we get into that, we'll have a brief chat about the 19th century romantic hero, capital R. So capital R doesn't necessarily have anything to do with love. It's just a case of this is the person that would be cast as the lead in those sorts of stories. Yeah. And again, they tend to be quite athletic and well proportioned, shall we say, and often rich from the right sort of background. And, you know, even if you're looking at things like the Allan Quatermain type stories and things by Edgar Rice Burroughs, not Edgar Allan Poe, Edgar Rice Burroughs, you would have, again, the idea of this stalwart, upright, handsome man who nevertheless is intelligent and, you know, very athletic and physically capable.
Yeah.
And, you know, the whole 19th century romantic hero, sort of the Byronic hero as well, they've all come about and brought you this great swathe of romantic heroes in modern literature.
Yeah, it's quite interesting because it's become such a image as well. It also tends to be connected kind of with these certain types of looks. So the dark hair, kind of the yeah. pale skin, the sort of the tall, sort of tall, upright, kind of usually quite severe features. So much so that actually there are examples of 19th century literature where characters are not described like this, and yet in adaptations they've been made to look like that. I mean, one in particular is The Picture of Dorian Gray, right? Yeah. Dorian Gray in this is not supposed to be a romantic hero. He's not. He's meant to be this beautiful, blonde, bratty child who doesn't really think of the consequences of what he's doing. And yet in all these adaptations, he's made to be this swarthy, very, you know, attractive. Not that he's not attractive. He's obviously meant to be attractive in the book as well. But this kind of this romantic, mysterious hero. And that's not his character at all. And yet it's become so heavily associated with this kind of genre that you find these particular looks, these particular characters being pushed in, even if they weren't there originally.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not just things, obviously, like classic literature or romance novels. We're looking at things like comic books, graphic novels. Yeah. Think of Superman, for example. In fact, think of most of the heroes. Most of them have these sort of classic good looks and height and things. You know, there are a few definite exceptions, but generally that's what you're looking at. And, you know, if they're going the all-American route, quite often they're tall and blonde and even-teethed and blue-eyed, you know.
Yeah. Superman is quite interesting. Batman you can definitely see because he is, you know, this. He lives in a place called Gotham. I mean, obviously it's gothic. He is the typical kind of gothic character, the man with a secret, you know, the secret identity, the intelligent, he's rich. Quite interesting when you look at Superman. Superman, I think, isn't a gothic character in the same way. He's definitely got those attractive kind of features, but in his conception, what was sort of generally considered quite attractive was the kind of the blonde, blue-eyed, as you said. And he was, of course, created by two Jewish men during, you know, this period where, strangely enough, the Jewish people had not been treated particularly well. You might remember it, the Holocaust and all that. And he's also, you know, he's this immigrant who's arrived on the planet and yet becomes the world's saviour and things like that. Which again has kind of played into things as well. But I think certainly with Batman really, really is the epitome of that gothic hero, kind of made even gnarlier as we sort of walked forward. He's a mix between the gothic hero and Sherlock Holmes, essentially.
Yeah. So this has obviously certainly influenced the rise of the alpha male trope in books, particularly in paranormal romance. I'm not going to go too much into this, but, you know, the term alpha is a misnomer because there is no such thing as an alpha male in the animal kingdom, not in the way that people understand it. It's largely taken from wolf packs. Mm. If you actually study wolves and look at wolf packs, the wolf traveling at the end, the one that's watching all the others go forward, that's the alpha. The alpha isn't out front in pole position. The alpha is the one making sure that all the wolves can keep up. Yeah. It's the one being responsible, looking after the cubs, looking after all the others. Yeah. So it is not the same thing. It's not kind of like, I am the best, I'm the most prime specimen, therefore I get to breed, which is kind of where people take it and assume that that's what it's about, and it's not at all. Partly why that term kind of really pisses me off. On the other hand, as I've said before in another episode, there's a reason why alpha males pop up, and there's a reason why they're sort of concurrent with the demon lover fantasy. Yeah. And it is a lot to do with, you know, freeing the sexual agency of women as well. having this very potent masculine force that means that she's almost overpowered by her own desires, etc., etc.
Yeah.
So I get
it. And she's not responsible for them either.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, so there's a good reason for it, but it's really, really boring, and I don't like it as a trope. So basically, your general romantic hero, I'm not interested.
So let's talk about the romantic hero, or rather the hero, the unromantic hero, that we are interested in.
I think the first time I really started considering this and considering why I liked the characters I actually liked, I'd heard someone, in fact, it was actually an ex-boyfriend saying to me, nice guys finish last.
Oh yeah, nice guys finish last. Was he wearing a fedora at the time?
He was not wearing a fedora at the time.
No, it's not a fedora, a trilby.
That would have made...
It's a trilby, isn't it?
Or a trilby. He wasn't wearing a hat.
Okay, all right.
That would have made the entire situation really, really fucking weird. Put it this way, there's a reason an ex-boyfriend might be saying to somebody that nice guys finish last.
Yeah.
And I remember going away and I was in my early 20s and thinking, is that true? Nice guys finish last. Is that genuinely the perception? And I realised that, yes, it is genuinely a perception and quite a big one, but it's not necessarily true when I thought about my female friends and who they were into and who they went out with, who they lusted after, and who they actually ended up with.
Yeah.
And then I know there are people who would then say, oh, well, that's settling. And actually, I don't think it is settling. I think that's, okay, well, yes, that's who I liked for an exciting night in a bathroom in a club somewhere, but that's not the person I wanted to take home and wake up with.
Yeah. It always got me, because first of all, it's such a sexist statement, because you never say, nice girls finish last. No, one ever does that at all. And there's this perception that all women kind of want the big, the stud, the alpha male kind of person, which again, fine if you want that, absolutely fine. And fine if that's the kind of person you are. Personally, I don't think that anyone is ever one particular way or another. Because
no, absolutely not.
These are archetypes, you know, they're just caricatures that you see in books. They're not real people. And real people are obviously a little bit more complicated than all of that. But yeah, it always, the nice guys finish last thing always pissed me off for so many reasons. And that was definitely one of them. But yeah, I think you're right, Jules, that when I sort of look at sort of my friends and the kind of the people, I mean, my own preferences have always been plain. I tended to always get annoyed with kind of the guy who was meant to be the romantic hero, and usually wasn't particularly interested in them. I was usually more interested in the other character, who we'll talk about in a minute. But yeah, the nice guys finish last thing just isn't true, and I tend to find that people who sort of make that statement aren't particularly nice guys, because it's not actually about the relationship side of things. It tends to actually be more about the sex side of things.
Yeah, that's certainly an aspect when somebody says that to you. I mean, I'm kind of hoping that because this was like 20 years ago, that people aren't really getting that said to them when they're breaking up with someone now, or when they're checking in on someone they still care about but aren't, you know, together yeah. with, which was what was happening with me in that scenario.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's a statement that even I heard in school, and I remember thinking, yeah, it's true, you get all these nice guys, and then I was like, why? It's this expectation that puts on women, which says you should be dating people that you're not attracted to, and it also makes a statement of this idea that women are only attracted to this one particular kind of man who is not the nice guy, which is also not true, and the whole thing is messy. Yeah.
Well, it is basically the idea of, this is classic incel logic as well, yeah. isn't it? As in, I want to have sex with you, you don't want to have sex with me, you want to have sex with someone who to me looks like a classic Chad, which means you're a Stacey. I would quite still like to have sex with you, but you can't see past his alpha male bullshit.
Yeah.
You should be going for a nice guy like me, and you should be saving yourself for someone like me. And it all just becomes this incredibly toxic mess. Yeah. And I genuinely believe that 90% of the men who say this sort of shit online, if they'd actually spent any time with women, would realise that it's a complete bollocks.
Yeah.
That it's just not true. If they actually tried treating women like people, they wouldn't have any trouble.
Well, yeah, most of them. That's the thing, is that relationships, even if you see these guys kind of getting lots and lots of sex, they're not really getting a lot of relationships in terms of, you know, the Chad sort of character. And that begs the question of, oh, look at him, he's with a different girl every week. Okay, so he's not having a relationship with a different girl every week, is he? He's having sex with a different girl every week. That's a different thing. And so, which makes me think, anytime someone says nice guys finish last, you're thinking about sex. You're not thinking about a relationship, because relationships take time and effort. And if you go into it chasing, you know, the sexy side of things only, you might find that nothing particularly happens, particularly if that person isn't physically attracted to you. And also on the understanding that actually physical attraction isn't just that first initial look. Physical attraction can develop, can grow. And for some people, they don't feel physical attraction until there is some kind of emotional attraction. And for a lot of women, having an emotional connection or something like that, or having, you know, an emotional side of things does add to it, even if that is just the excitement of being with a hot guy in an exciting sort of scenario for those people who enjoy those things, you know?
Yeah, I have to say, from a personal perspective here, that I still am, but I was genuinely baffled as a teenager when people would get really enthusiastic lusting over someone, and I'm like, but you've never met them. Like, well, I know I haven't met them, but look at them. And I'm like, okay, well, aesthetically I can see that everything's in the right place. And yes, it's quite pleasing to look at. I'm not genuinely feeling any real attraction here. And I thought there was something wrong with me for a really, really long time. And it was only later that I was thinking, maybe I just am not wired to be attracted to people based on their looks. And I really thought it was me, obviously, because I have a sister who's 13 months younger than me. We're really close together in age. And she did get the genuine physical attraction to someone she didn't know. And it's like, am I just wired up wrong? Obviously, that's not true at all. It's just I happen to be wired in a way that means that I need to know I can have a conversation with somebody at least before I'll be attracted to them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm the same way. I spent a large amount of time going, is something wrong with me, before I even heard the word demi. And I suddenly realised, oh wait, you mean it's possible not to really feel sexual attraction to someone until you kind of have some sort of emotional or, you know, intellectual bond with them? Wild.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just, it was kind of a relief, actually.
Yeah.
It was like, oh no, I'm not broken. It's just that and there would be things where I'd look at somebody, and because I had a bit more of a connection with them, I'd be like, they're so good looking. This person is really incredibly attractive. And other people would be saying, yeah, but look at them. They've got a massive, massive long nose, and their ears stick out, and they're a bit on the skinny side, or they're a bit on the podgy side. And like, but can't you see what I see? Because obviously they genuinely couldn't, but it wasn't me going, oh yeah, I like to bat low because that way I know that I can be the one who'll leave, which was something that was suggested to me by another bloke. I've met some real shits.
Yeah,
in my time.
Seriously, yeah.
It was a genuine, I see people differently, and I see them differently based on what connection I make with them.
Yeah, absolutely. For me, one of the big things was just, are they kind? Like, the whole brooding arsehole thing is so tired. And one of big attraction for me is funny and kind. And, you know, that's that. That makes a difference. I just cannot be attracted to someone who's an arsehole. There you go.
That's it. Well, it's like, they can have a bit of an arsehole sort of edge, as it were, but, you know, if that's all there is, that's not interesting. Yeah. I don't care how good looking they are.
No, don't get me wrong. You can be sarcastic and cynical, and you might even have sort of occasionally snap nasty things, but it's just about a general kind of character. if that's all you are. So yeah, and that was the problem, I guess, with the way that a lot of romantic heroes were sort of displayed. Which is... sorry, this comes to Wuthering Heights again. Everyone just going, it's so romantic. And I'm like, I cannot think of anything which is more disgusting to me at all.
We will talk about Wuthering Heights later, because that's a very special case. So we're still kind of on the nice guys finish last thing. Basically, it's not true. And yes, a certain amount of physical attraction to someone is necessary, I would say. But that physical attraction might stem from lots of different things. It is not entirely looks-based for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. It's certainly not for me or Madeline or many, many other people, many other women. And ultimately, you might have someone who, and this could be male or female, who are, you know, looking at somebody on screen or in a magazine or something and saying, oh God, they're so amazing, they're so fit, etc. But that's not who they necessarily... That's the fantasy. That's not necessarily who they'd actually want to end up with. So, yes, a certain amount of physical attraction is kind of desirable. But ultimately, looks don't really matter. What most people are looking for, if they're looking for a relationship, not just sex, is companionship. Yeah. Someone they can have a good time with.
Exactly. So, now we get to the atypical romantic hero. So this is the hero that I tend to be drawn to. I think Jules tends to be drawn to them as well.
Do you think?
Just maybe a little idea, maybe a little nudge in that direction. So how can they be classed? Well, usually they're not classically good-looking.
Yeah, you probably find that the heroine, or another hero maybe, might be looking at them and thinking... Or they might even look at them and say, oh, they're quite plain to start with, or even they're quite ugly, and then they'll notice like one feature that they think is quite nice for some reason.
Or they might actually be still good looking, but they're not meant to be as good looking as the main character. So sometimes the atypical romantic hero might be the romantic hero's best friend. So Darcy and Mr. Bingley, for instance. Darcy's meant to be the shits, you know. Sorry, that sounds so strange.
It did sound a little weird, but carry on.
He's meant to be, like, the be-all and end-all, and not just because he's rich. And Mr. Bingley, he's not meant to be as attractive. And he's certainly not got those same characteristics as well. He's jolly, he's jovial, he's quite sweet-tempered. He doesn't seem to be as intelligent. So the atypical romantic hero is usually not classically good-looking. Again, that doesn't mean that they're ugly. And particularly in movies, it's almost impossible to get someone who's ugly anyway. Because, I don't know, directors are allergic to ugly people. So they just have to film the good-looking ones. Not classically good looking. They might be awkward, or maybe a little bit sort of, so that they might be awkward in terms of what they say, or what they do, a little bit socially awkward, or a little bit kind of uncertain of themselves, easy to push around, not as domineering or dominant. And usually quite quite unassuming, really.
See, unassuming is the interesting part for me, because I think it goes so contra to the sort of alpha male romantic hero trope.
Yeah.
Where you've got someone who, he'll enter a room and he sort of dominates all attention. And as entertaining as that is, I want someone to do that by accident and then realise that they're the centre of attention and they're really embarrassed by the whole thing and all they're trying to do is escape.
Yeah.
Because I think that would be really, really funny. That would be a great unromantic hero trope.
Yeah.
But yeah, you can also have the ones who are kind of like, you know, somewhere along the line their confidence has been quite dented, or they're just not interested in being the centre of attention, so they kind of hang back.
Or they might be the centre of attention, but not in a usually a positive way. So they might be a bit of a clown character. They might be the butt of jokes. They might be considered a little bit stupid, you know, and not usually taken particularly seriously.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, you also get the nerdy guys and the ones who are a bit skinnier, a bit pudgy, the atypical, not very sort of ripped straight out of a gym body type.
It's like literally any other body type.
Yeah, pretty much, literally.
Any other body type of someone who's not dehydrated.
You could be forgiven for thinking that there was no other body type, looking at sort of films and TV shows with the heroes. In fairness, I have to say, I find Henry Cavill to be quite a nice piece of moving wallpaper to look at.
I'll agree. Aesthetically, he's pleasing. It's certainly true.
He's pleasing to the eye, but it's kind of like, I can't honestly say I'm attracted, because I found him more attractive when I realised that he likes books and he's also a ginormous nerd, and it's kind of like, okay, now you're interesting as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's
like, I'm not lusting after you, but you're more interesting to me now.
It's funny. I always think of this, which is, someone made an example about kind of actually the sort of the female gaze versus the male gaze, and what's sort of like, particularly in superheroes. And they had two magazine covers released at the same time for two different magazines, one for a male magazine, one for a female magazine. I say female, you know, it was sort of like Home Life or something like that. Usually the audience is centered towards women and men. And so for the men's magazine, they had Hugh Jackman, you know, like veins bulging, dehydrated so that you could see every crevasse of every ab and muscle, you know, he's roaring, he's in full Wolverine mode, right?
Yeah.
And then for the women's one, Hugh Jackman again, wearing this lovely blue jumper, you know, clean shaven, his hair sort of pushed back, smiling, his eyes bright. I was like, there you go. Really want to understand what women actually want. It wasn't the bulging muscles with this, that, because that's all very sort of, ooh, very impressive as a sculpture. But the other guy looks nicer to maybe sit and have a cup of tea with.
And also there's the whole jumper porn aspect.
Oh god, yeah.
Knitwear. It's my kryptonite, seriously. You can put a jumper on someone I'm not really attracted to and suddenly they get plus 10 attractiveness if it's a decent cable knit.
Yeah, I was
going
to say, if it's cable knit, ooh, you've got Jules. You want Jules to be attracted to any character, just pop on a cable knit sweater. I mean, I mentioned Galahad in Kestrel, put on a cable knit sweater and I could hear Jules fanning herself.
Jules was fanning herself. Jules had not previously found Galahad attractive. She just thought he was quite, you know, pretty and nice. not really interesting, and then she sticks a bloody jumper on him. We're talking about a fictional character.
Oh, it's
like,
my. Well,
thank you for making me see. Yeah, thank you for making me see him like that. It's even worse when you realise that, you know, your male characters who you want someone to, your readers to start thinking that they are attractive because they're seeing them through the eyes of your narrator. Mm-hmm. And you realise that you've put them in jumpers and you didn't realise that you did it.
I can always tell who you find attractive, Jules, in your own writing, because they'll be wearing a cable knit sweater.
At some point they'll wear a cable knit sweater, probably.
I'll just be reading it, it's like, oh, there we go, there's the sweater. Anyway, small caveat there about Jules' very particular...
My particular fetish.
Your particular fetish.
Madeline reads my books and goes, ah, there we go, there's the money shot, right? I need help, clearly. It could be a really ugly jumper as well. There was, I'm gonna talk about this because Alan found it hilariously funny at the time, but we went and saw Aquaman at the cinema. I have never yet managed to get through that entire film without falling asleep because I'm just not interested. And I don't find Jason Momoa particularly attractive. And there he was in the water, up to his waist in water, with his shirt off, and every rippling pectoral on display. And I was just like, eh. And then someone hands him this ugly ass orange jumper and he puts it on. And I was like, oh, shit. Alan actually turned to me in the cinema and said, so are you enjoying the jumper porn then? And I'm like, oh god, you know me far too well. I need to go into the east to remain Galadriel. This is not good.
Oh, it kills me. It really kills me. Okay.
Sorry about that. So, just to illustrate that the whole looks thing is not a fixed quality. Yeah,
just put someone in a jumper and chill.
Just put someone in a jumper, it's fine. I'll do. I'm a little bit more picky than that, but a jumper definitely helps.
Eases the way.
I've got to be the... I mean, I must be the only person on the planet who actually wants to put clothes on men to make them more attractive.
Oh, beautiful. Thank you. Thank you for... I think you've just added about 20 years to my life just from this conversation alone. Okay, so...
yeah, before, you know what, I'm gonna, okay, just to help correct the jumper mm-hmm. thing, I've got a very, very little story about, me hanging out with some friends in Weymouth, and I was, you know, I tend to stay good friends generally with my ex-boyfriends, and I was hanging out with one in particular, mm-hmm. and his mates, and I sort of knew all of them, and we'd all been to college together at Weymouth, and it was his birthday, it was my ex-boyfriend's birthday, and we were sort of all hanging out in a pub down at Brewer's Quay in Weymouth. And it was fun. And then the one person that I kind of didn't want to come along turned up. And the reason was this guy, I think in hindsight, looking back now, because this is many years ago, was kind of desperate for attention.
Right.
And was a bit socially inept and didn't know how to go about getting it. And what he used to do was he would take over any scene like that and just talk over everybody. And then anyone who sort of tried to engage him, he would talk down to them.
Right.
And a whole bunch of people were kind of like, would just ignore him. And I tried to be one of the ones who ignored him, but he did used to really piss me off. But what really got me was he would very particularly talk down to this ex-boyfriend of mine, who's still a really, really close friend. And this guy hadn't gone off to university. He'd gone into an apprenticeship at the time instead.
Right.
Which meant that when we all came out of university, like, really, really broke, he kind of had money and a house and stuff. So, you know, you can decide who made the wrong choice there. Really,
yeah.
But I think he always kind of felt like the lack of a university education. And this guy had just completed his doctorate in nanotechnology.
Mm-hmm.
Which sounds really impressive, but largely it's making technology really small.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm being flippant, that's what it is. And obviously I understood everything he was saying. I just didn't find it very interesting. And I got really fed up with him just sort of talking down to everyone and taking over the group. And he broke up the evening. Everyone just got so fed up that everyone just went, no, oh, we're all going home. So everyone hived off out of the pub, and this guy came along as well. My ex and three of his mates kind of started walking really, really fast, and they just left me behind with this complete dick. So at that point, I was not happy. I was not a happy person. And I was trying to catch up with the others, but this guy was just talking at me and he would not let me go. And finally he said, I don't understand it. He said, I make a good living. I've got a doctorate in nanotechnology. I'm intelligent. I'm good looking. He's like, why don't I have a girlfriend, Jules? And I just sort of looked at him and he said, I don't understand. What's wrong with me? And he kept going on. And finally I turned to him and said, you haven't got a girlfriend because you're an arse. And he went absolutely silent. And I said, it doesn't matter that you've got all the rest of it going on, because the minute you open your mouth, you're a complete dick. Nobody likes that. Nobody's attracted to that. And you keep talking down to people. It doesn't matter if you think they're stupid. You can't act like that publicly and expect them to like you. That's why no one is hanging out with you. That's why they've abandoned you with me. And I went on for about 15 minutes. And when I finally stopped, he went, oh. And he went really quiet. And then 10 minutes later, well, thank you for being honest. I went back to my flat and, you know, sobered up a little bit more. And in the morning I thought, ooh, maybe I was a little bit harsh with him. But then again, he did ask me straight out. And I didn't see him for a while after that. But I heard back from my ex a few times. And he said, what did you say to him? I'm like, well, I might have been a bit blunt. He said, well, what have you said to me? It worked, because he's actually being really nice. 6 months after that, he had a lovely girlfriend.
Aww.
A year after that, they'd moved in together. 2 years after that, they'd got married. I think they're married with children now. And, you know, Pete, that my ex just kind of went, you know, okay, tell me exactly what you said to him. So I explained. He said, right, okay, the minute he starts to forget, we're all going to remind him. And they did, and they kept doing it, and he kept correcting his behaviour.
There you go.
which is why I genuinely think that most of the sort of incels you get online can genuinely be corrected, because they just literally need someone to tell them in person that they're a dick and that's why no one likes them.
Yeah.
And if they take it on board and change their behaviour, suddenly they'll have everything they want.
Yeah. I mean, behaviour stems from something, that's the thing. And if you address where that's coming from, because it might very well be a chip on his shoulder, you know, it could be anything. It could have been him overcompensating for something. If you address that, then things can change. So
yes. So anyway, that's a very, very extreme example of an unromantic hero, and honestly not one I'm attracted to.
No.
But these people do exist in real life, and there is a reason, you know, I'm known for being blunt and not necessarily pulling my punches when it comes to things. And I've got so much better at that as I've got older. But, you know, in my 20s, I was kind of like, no, fine, you've asked, I'm going to fucking tell you. It wasn't always a bad thing.
No.
So, back to unromantic heroes. We've talked about some of the characteristics, and we've talked about some of the traits not commonly associated with romantic heroes. Madeline brought up kindness.
And
I would like to add empathy and, you know, thoughtfulness, but the, you know, the sort of thoughtfulness where they don't then ask for a medal because they've thought of something.
Yeah. It's just sort of, you tend to find these characters, they just sort of do things because it's their natural state. They don't have to be told to do something. And this is something else that you tend to get with a lot of the romantic heroes, is that the romantic heroes, some of their faults might very well be that they actually kind of need to be told to be kind. They kind of need to be mothered a tiny bit. And then once that's pushed, they sort of start to actually show that they've got a natural kind side underneath it all. Whereas this is a kind of character who just does it automatically. It's already a part of their day-to-day, and it's a quiet part of their day-to-day, which they just sort of get on with.
Is that, I don't think enough is made of kindness as a character trait, just someone who's genuinely a kind person.
Yeah.
Or, you know, who will choose the kind option whenever they have to make a choice. Because, it, you know, it seems like such a small thing, and not very much is made of it, but it can really change how you perceive somebody.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, I think of Bingley from, for some really stupid reason, and I'm going to have to share this now, my brain just completely misfired there, and I was genuinely, and I mean genuinely, about to say, this is why I think of Bingley from Star Trek.
That's an interesting genre crossover.
Some real jumping there. I don't know how it happened.
No.
From Pride and Prejudice. He's just actually a very genuine, empathetic person who immediately wants to get involved. He doesn't think of himself as better simply because he comes from money, and he kind of smooths over things, and he seems to see the best in everybody.
Yeah.
So he's very sweet. But yeah, some of the negative sides that you might find for our unromantic hero, however, could also be things like insecurity,
And
prickliness, and pomposity.
The sort of things you use to keep people at a distance.
Yes. I will be giving you a long list of examples of characters, some of who I have been ranting about for the last few weeks, which display all of these things.
Definitely. So, why do we like unromantic heroes? Well, for me, it's the balance of power in an eventual relationship is more nuanced.
Yeah.
And I think it's fair to say that I find that an unromantic hero character is actually more nuanced in general.
Mm. Yeah, I think you're right. And I think that there's just the fact that because it's a little bit more nuanced, and because it's usually far less dramatic, it's a little bit more realistic as well.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And it doesn't mean these guys are perfect. They're not just Mr. Nice Guy and they get pushed around.
No.
They will have their moments of saying or doing something that's a bit off, because everybody does. But...
yeah. And they...
or, you know, just really screwing something up.
Yeah, really screwing something up, or actually needing room to grow, to be a better person. You know, we're not saying that they're 100% there yet either. They're just not the romantic hero who's sort of at centre stage.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think you're right that they're just... the relationships that do happen are more nuanced. They're actually usually involve less kind of, not necessarily less drama, but it's not quite as be all and end all usually, even if it is actually involves some really deep and cutting and emotional things. And I just tend to find them more realistic. And you just look at that and you feel, you sort of tend to see these characters, you're like, you are actually a viable partner, rather than a kind of a whimsical
I guess daydream. This is going to be a really weird comparison, but it's kind of like horses in the sense of I'm great with the random
you really
today
are.
Jumpers, horses, people who have doctorates in nanotechnology. But it's like, if you want, okay, let's say you don't have a car but you have a horse, mm-hmm. you don't want a thoroughbred, because that's only really good for a very specific task.
Yeah.
You want an all-purpose horse that's quite good at... this is not going anywhere good, is it, Madeline?
No, it's not. It's
ultimately,
it's not going... if you want to stop while you're ahead.
I should stop right there. But, yeah, what I'm saying is, I know that a thing of beauty is supposed to be a joy forever, but personally, a thing of beauty also needs to have some use,
yeah,
in my opinion.
Yeah. It does sound
I've
like
just
you're
objectified.
Shopping. You're totally objectifying.
I've just totally objectified all men. Kind of, yes, you can be beautiful, but you must be useful when you're at it. I would like to reiterate, I'm sure I've said this on a previous podcast, but do not come to me for dating advice. I'm not the person to give it to you. I will, however, give you one free "you're a total dick" conversation if you need it.
Jules means well, but she doesn't always say it like it is.
No, Jules always says it like it is. That's quite the problem.
No, I mean that when it comes to the unintentional objectification of men, they're comparing you to thoroughbreds and whatnot.
what I'm getting at, I suppose, is that someone who has a lot of their identity tied up in their appearance,
yeah,
is very high maintenance.
Yeah.
And if they don't have anything else to balance that out, not only is that a boring and quite hollow, but that's not a comfortable person to spend a lot of time with.
No, it isn't.
And that's regardless of gender, ultimately.
We can also go into the cost. Nice car, horse. Anyway.
Yes.
Moving on from that unfortunate metaphor, but you did make your point.
I could have just gone with sports car.
You could have.
Why did I go to horses? It's because I've been reading medieval literature.
That's what it is. So I think the next bit is that macho bullshit is so boring.
It really is.
I'm just tired of it. But also, like, and this is the thing, is that macho people think that macho means that it's all about the physical side of things, without realizing that you can have macho bullshit, you can have that kind of vibe in any kind of scenario where there's this, I'm trying to get the one up on you. So, you know, you can have macho intellectuals, as it were, who are being sneery and things like that. You can have macho nerds who are all kind of challenging, but are you a real gamer? You know, can you name all of these things? It's exactly the same thing as saying, how much do you bench press, bro? You know, it's kind of that whole macho thing is really tiring and boring. And it's different from being competitive. And it's different from being, you know, having a healthy sort of passion for something. It's when you apply a really negative kind of trait of pure identity based on what you can do and the need to assert yourself as the best in everything over somebody else.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, unromantic heroes. We've kind of talked about this, but they make more interesting characters because there's more room for growth. Yes.
Particularly if they start with like a chip on their shoulder, or you know they're a bit of a fool or something like that. They have a place, a direction to go in.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I think the thing is, if you start from the perspective of the romantic hero, a lot of times there's nowhere left for them to go because their character journey is nearly always, I am complete and confident in myself, but this one woman has turned my head kind of thing, and that's it.
Hark.
And I understand why other people find that an appealing story, but I find that a little bit dull.
Yeah, well, I get you. Also, it's the underdog, man.
Yeah, ship harder for the underdog.
Yep.
Root for the underdog.
Root for the underdog.
As long as the underdog's not a complete asshole, obviously. Yes.
Okay, so let's actually look at some examples of unromantic or atypically romantic heroes.
Yes. Okay, I wrote down Hitch. Presumably everyone's seen that film because it's been out for ages and ages and ages. Yeah. And it has Will Smith in it.
Yeah.
And what I like about Hitch is that he's very good at, you know, working out ways for people to make connections. He doesn't force people into groups, but if they've got potential, then he's quite good at, you know, he sort of runs a dating consultancy.
Yeah.
And his boast is he can make any guy attractive to any girl because he knows it's not based on looks if that the girl is at all a decent person.
Yeah.
So he's good at making those initial connections so that the guy gets the opening without resorting to manipulation, which is what a lot of sort of seduction is about.
Yeah.
And yet, when it's him,
yeah,
he's this really, really cool guy. When it's him and someone he really likes, he fucks up royally.
He really does. I think it's because he tries to do all the regular things and then suddenly realises that none of that works. None of the sort of pre-written plans work, as it were.
Yeah, he kind of forgets that what he has been helping these other guys to do, mm-hmm. or other girls as well, in fact, what he's been helping them to do is be the most best and genuine versions of themselves to create that opening for someone to find them interesting. And obviously it's not going to work all the time, but it works a lot of the time if the other person's looking for a genuine connection, and most people are.
Yeah.
And then he forgets and tries to make himself something else.
Yeah.
And because he's not being himself, he screws up. And it's just really, really funny because he is ultimately, despite the coolness and everything the rest of the time, he is completely the unromantic hero in that respect.
But also the guy he's working with is also obviously a bit of an unromantic hero as well. And
yeah,
it's a nice movie all in all. I think to begin with, yeah, he's a little bit overconfident, and then he sort of has relearned what it means to connect with people, which I think makes a big difference.
Yeah.
So yeah, I will agree with you on that. So now it's my turn. I'm just going to go out straight away and come up with this and just talk about Steve from Unveiled. So I can't obviously talk about Steve too much in the next series, which I'm privy to at the moment and nobody else is. Ah! I've been reading Jules's latest books, which she's sort of rattling out at an alarming rate, and I have fallen head over heels for Steve in them. And there is a character, I shall not name who I really pair him with. And again, no spoilers, but it is just painful. It's just painful because I'm looking at Steve and going, this guy is pure 100% romance, romantic, you know, option. Like, if this were a game, like, if this were an RPG, I would be romancing the shit out of him. like, 10 out of 10, he's brilliant. And this has been a real change for me, because obviously in kind of, when we first meet him in Unveiled, I wasn't particularly interested, but then Kieran was also in the scene, so, you know, difficult to spot him.
Yes.
And, but also, the nice thing is that Steve has obviously grown as a character, and he has a lot of these traits that we've mentioned. So he's a bit pompous. He's quite prickly. He's very insecure. But he also has that great kindness and empathy and thoughtfulness. He's not classically good-looking in the least. And he's a little bit awkward, and he's a massive nerd. And all of these things are just such big ticks. I mean, to be honest, Jules, I'm surprised you haven't put him in a jumper yet.
I'm sure that's coming.
It's coming.
I mean, winter is coming, so he's going to end up in a jumper. It'd be funny, actually, if you knew who bought him a jumper and, you know, that changed perspectives a bit.
Oh, goodness me. Oh, you're going to throw a spanner in the works. Someone else buys him a jumper. And then I'll be like, oh, now there, the love interest. Just follow the trail of jumpers.
Yeah. He's really come into his own. He's a lovely character. He's a great character to write. And yeah, as Madeline says, he's not perfect. He's got a serious chip on his shoulder.
Yeah.
There are good reasons for that. And I think when you meet him in Unveiled, he's still very much the, okay, well, I can't be anything my family approves of, so I'm going to be this flamboyant goth and I'm going to push everyone away because that way they can't reject me. And he's genuinely off-putting in it, and it's something that he does very deliberately. And obviously, when you meet him in the Harker and Blackthorn series, which is what I'm writing at the moment, he's 26, so he's grown up a bit. And he's sort of come into his own in the things that he's interested in. And he still has a lot of stuff to deal with. But the friendship he formed at university with the other guys has made a big difference to him.
Yeah.
And he sort of falls in with the Harker and Blackthorn group, and it starts to finish off that process or move him on to the next stage.
It's, I think also, to be honest, it's particularly refreshing because I'm now reading about adults. And I mean, I loved Unveiled. You know, I loved Unveiled. They were all teenagers, and that was fine, you know. And then they were kind of in, getting into university, and they were sort of bordering on that. But to see him now as an adult, and it just changes things. And big tick from me. So yeah, you guys can all look forward to that, and you will all get what I mean.
Okay. Well, I think obviously I personally love Steve too. Mm-hmm. I love the fact that I sent Madeline a snippet and it was like 3 paragraphs long and she immediately went, well, I ship him with this person. And I'm like, you haven't even read the book yet. Nope, ship him.
It was.
Like, are you sure? Because they're just really good friends.
It was instantaneous. You were like, here, read this. And I'm like, right, those two belong with each other. You were like, what? You've had no context for anything that's happening. I'm like, I've made my bed. I'm lying in it. And I have not got out of this bed. I'm 4 books in. I am staying in this bed. This bed has grown. It is even more made than it was before. I'm even more laying in it.
Yeah, I mean, if you're someone who liked Unveiled and is probably likely to follow these books because they sort of follow on in a separate context, then I apologise. I've not really released anything this year so far. But on the plus side, when I finally do release these books, you won't have to wait very long in between each book. So there's that. Right. For me, I think I was having this conversation with Jen Williams, who's a fantasy author, on Twitter. I was talking about The Last Unicorn, and she said Schmendrick. And I'm like, oh my God. And she's like, yeah, he was my first fantasy crush. And I'm like, me too.
Yes!
Because Schmendrick the magician is useless as an actual magician. He tries really,
he's really
hard.
Trying.
Just screws everything up.
He's really trying.
He's really, really trying. And you know, he's skinny and gawky and a little bit sort of rubbish.
He's got a huge nose as well, doesn't he?
Yeah, he has got a huge nose. He's got, and you would not look at him and go, "Oh, that's a romantic hero." But he's so much more interesting than say a golden prince.
Yeah, to be honest, yeah, I was big tick from me with the Schmendrick, who I really liked, and I super paired Schmendrick with what's her name, the woman
Molly.
Yeah,
Grew.
Molly. I super paired them. Forget the other two.
It's like, yeah, I'm not really worried about the beautiful people.
Yeah. They'll be fine. These two, however, they should get together. They're very sweet. So yes, big tick there. I want to mention, and you're going to be so sick of me for doing this, Jules. But I'm going to mention Lucien from A Court of Thorns and Roses.
Is he an unromantic hero, though? Because he's actually supposed to be quite good looking until he loses an eye.
Well, I think he is an unromantic hero, though. I think because the problem is that they're all supposed to be good looking. And comparatively, you know, Rhys is supposed to be the best looking. Tamlin is supposed to be good looking under Rhys, and then Cassian and Asriel and stuff like that. And Lucien is kind of below all of that. So I think within perspective, he's kind of meant to be a bit more of average looking. He's also got massive scar the whole way down his face, you know. He's also not given the typical traits of someone who's attractive, and weirdly enough, he tends to be given the traits that you put towards a side character. So red hair, for some reason, unless it's a woman, you can have a red-headed woman, but you don't often get red-headed men who are the main characters. They're more likely to be the best friends, like Ronald Weasley, who really, again, falls into this category. But I do think of Lucien as an unromantic hero, because typically with Tamlin, you have this very alpha male kind of character. And Lucien is a bit of a lapdog for him. Kind of gets pushed around, tries to sort of push back a few times, but doesn't quite get there. Demonstrates small acts of kindness in comparison to Tamlin, who demonstrates these huge, oh, look, I've fed your entire family kind of thing. But Lucia does small thoughtful things, such as stealing a cloak to kind of keep Feyre warm and things along those lines, which kind of go unremarked. And he's got this kind of stuff going on in the background, so I'm willing to fight you on this, Jules. I'm willing to stand my ground for this one.
Well, it's not I think you're wrong, it's just I haven't given it the degree of thought which you have.
But you know why.
But I know why. I know. You know, he's your jam.
It's my jam indeed.
I'm going to mention one that Madeline can also comment on, and that is the character Owen from The Haunting of Bly Manor.
Oh, Owen.
He's an absolute cinnamon roll. He's so sweet.
And I think the problem is that, again, because directors are allergic to ugly people, the actor is supposed, you know, the character of Owen, but even within the series, they say, you know, half of the village are in love with him. He's not meant to be as attractive as the main guy, who's also a very attractive guy, very sexy accent in particular, the guy who plays Peter Quill. But Owen, he's just the biggest sweetheart. I was in love with him instantly.
Yeah, so was I. And it's things like his stupid puns.
Yeah.
The stupid puns and the fact that, you know, he's employed as the cook at Bly Manor.
Yeah.
And, okay, yeah, it's all tied in with what he does for a job, but he's really big on looking after everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's very sweet, he's kind, I think also in particular, you know, he's really sweet to the kids as well, but not in a, look how, you know, how good I am in that particular regard. I mean, because the guy is, yeah, so his name is Raoul Coley.
Yeah.
Which I think I'm getting it wrong. And yeah, the first time I saw him was, he was in iZombie, where once again, he was playing the atypical romantic hero. And I love the fact that everyone who was watching it was just there like, why is he the atypical one? Isn't the hottest person on screen at any given time. Like, they're trying to say, oh look, he's a bit awkward. There's not, like, no, everyone would be romantically interested in him. Look at him. He's sexy as all fuck. And he's adorable.
Yeah, he's lovely, and he's really got presence, and the actor really brings presence to whatever he's doing as well. And it's like, yeah, okay, I suppose if you put him next to the more classically proportioned bad boy, you can kind of see it. And he's obviously playing someone who's supposed to be a bit older as well.
Yeah, a little bit older. I think what they did the big thing with the mustache to really kind of sell that,
yes.
I think. That he's
That moustache is doing a lot of heavy lifting.
It's doing a lot of heavy lifting. But he's just... Oh, but the actor is, as I said, the actor is really very good looking. But as a character, and as a performer, I mean, he starts quoting Shakespeare every now and again as well, so he's really punny, and then every now and again it'll just come out with a little bit of Shakespeare, and I'm like, whoo, my.
Because I put it this way, I would have run off to Paris with him. They'd been like, bugger off, the lot of you, and the haunted house and everything else, you know, that's all very interesting, blah, blah, blah. He can cook, and he makes funny jokes.
And he came back, and he was caring for his mother, and he was just a compassionate person, and he's good with the kids, and he's funny, and he's sweet, and he's good. He's so good. And I really paired him with Hannah Gross when I was watching it. Oh, God, yeah. Those two. Run off to Paris together, you two. Forget everything else. Just go to Paris. Anyway. Reel it in.
Reeling it in, so there's no spoilers.
Yeah.
I've got one final one to mention, really, mm-hmm. I think. This is going to sound weird. Obviously, I talk about Robin Jarvis a fair bit, but the one
book... Oh, we're back to Robin Jarvis, are we?
Do you know, I have such an author crush on Robin Jarvis. Really, I think I have since I was like 14. Mm-hmm. I love the fact that Robin Jarvis admits that he does self-inserts of himself mm-hmm. in his books. What he does is he finds a character who's a bit pudgy and who's quite good at getting himself into scrapes and can't quite keep up with the others. And that's him. That's his self-insert. He's actually admitted this.
Aww.
And I just think that's adorable. but the character I'm thinking of is the bat, Vesper. Vespertilio, right. from the Oaken Throne, and he's the Oaken Throne is quite a complicated one because there's a war between the squirrels and the bats, which sounds ridiculous until you look at it and you realise that the bats have kind of been radicalised,
right,
to attack the squirrels because they think the squirrels are withholding the bats' birthright, which is not what's happening, and you end up with this entire Romeo and Juliet situation where the bats kind of unleash something. And a third party kind of unleashes something on the squirrels. And one young female squirrel is kind of like thrust into this thing where she absolutely has to undertake this terrible, harrowing quest. And she ends up being thrown in the path of this bat with a broken wing. And instead of having him murdered because, you know, her parents have just been like torn to pieces by this army of bats, she kind of said, okay, we'll have him treated and we'll just... They end up being thrown together. Mm-hmm. And they go through this awful quest together and they end up falling in love. So, okay, there's a whole cross-species thing there, which is obviously never going to work. But he's just... Again, he's funny and a little bit daft and, you know, brave and a bit nerdy. Gets things wrong. He ends up going up against his entire people and telling them that they're wrong. So it's kind of, you know, the unromantic hero thing, but having the courage to speak out when nobody else will,
yeah,
as well. So having that core of decency, and that's something that you see in these atypical romantic heroes.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, there you have it. Jules and I have basically just given you a full list of how to make us fall in love with your characters.
We have. Let's finish off with just a brief look at how the romantic hero trope has actually been challenged for a long time.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Madeline mentioned Wuthering Heights earlier. I still feel that Wuthering Heights, Emily Bronte was saying, yes, okay, this is your typical Byronic hero that all of you are sort of fanning yourselves and swooning over. Look at him. Really, really look.
Yeah.
And now look at the other version of the romantic hero, who is actually not vicious, but he's weak.
Yeah.
And the one that you wouldn't necessarily, you know, the best of a bad lot, ultimately, is Hareton. And it's a case of you kind of can't help but root for him a little bit more than the others, because by comparison, you know, he's definitely marriage material.
Yes.
So, yeah, I feel that she was kind of deconstructing the entire thing and, you know, love Wuthering Heights or hate Wuthering Heights or be wherever you are in the middle. That is very definitely what was happening. She was challenging this idea of the romantic hero. No one is the romantic hero, I think, is what she was getting at.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think the problem is that in a lot of the ways that it's been adapted and sort of read is that Heathcliff is put as the romantic hero, which I've never understood.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It's like, oh yes, he loves you so much he'll kill for you. And it's kind of like, yeah, that's like having a thing for the Phantom of the Opera.
Yeah.
You know, it's just not. Which,
again,
not
as a
cool
fictional character, fine. as a person, less fine.
Aim higher than a murderer. Yeah. You know, everyone can do that. Then there's Jane Eyre. Jane Eyre is interesting in that it is basically a Beauty and the Beast retelling.
Yes.
So while it's beauty of character, again, someone who is improving their character, even though they're quite beastly. And it's interesting that really the person you would peg as the romantic hero in the classical terms would be St. John Rivers.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, St. John being very good looking, well proportioned, with this great mission, this great destiny to go and be a missionary, obviously a God-fearing man, and, you know, quite boring.
Yep.
Ultimately. Whereas Rochester is ultimately a repentant sinner.
Yeah.
And, okay, there's going to be someone in the audience going, yeah, but he's nearly 20 years older than her, and so she's like, grow up, okay? Seriously, she was 19. You could get married, you could still get married at about 14 back then.
Yeah.
With parent permission. And it's just, try and read things in context, guys, basically. Yeah,
if it was a modern story, it would be a little bit different. But it's, again, it's of the era. It's also fiction.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, he, you know, Rochester is not a classic romantic hero, but I think he did then feed into the whole, oh, well, the romantic hero is not going to be this blue-eyed, blonde-haired boy anymore. He's going to be this dark, saturnine, troubled man with a difficult past.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that less adroit attempt at making the romantic hero more atypical kind of backfired after a few after a few generations.
Yeah, absolutely.
Pride and Prejudice is a great one. Mm-hmm. I'm not just going to talk 19th century novels. I like the way that Jane Austen swaps back and forth between who the romantic hero really is.
Yeah.
Because ultimately Bingley is a little bit weak and easily led, which is an atypical romantic hero trait.
Yeah.
Darcy is socially awkward, a little bit shy, and it comes out with him being a dick.
Yes.
Which again is an atypical romantic hero trait. He cannot talk to someone he genuinely likes.
No.
I mean, he's got a lot of other character stuff going on there as well, like his you know, his pride and his vanity, etc. Which are getting in the way of him looking at Elizabeth as a person.
Yes.
And treating her accordingly. So there's that as well. But I mean, Bingley is almost as bad in a way because he's not having the courage of his convictions.
Yeah, he allows himself to be convinced of things when he himself doesn't, yeah, he doesn't stand up for what he feels and believes in.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you have, oh God, what's it called? The scoundrel.
Wickham.
Wickham, thank you.
Mr. Wickham. Yes, the handsome man who's really got the chat. And
he walks the walk, he talks the talk.
Yeah, and I think he is actually Austen's worst villain. I mean, I think people lose the nuance of it. But, you know, if you haven't read the book, you've seen the adaptations. There are some great adaptations, but you lose the fact that what Austen is saying is this man's a sexual predator. Mm. You know, he's not a good guy. He's probably her worst villain because all he is about is his own amusement. And, you know... I know you could get married at 15, but Jane Austen is saying, you know, going after 14 and 15 year old girls
exclusively. When
you're a 20 something man,
yeah.
Exclusively, that's bad. That's someone that you don't actually want anywhere near your daughter.
Yeah, yeah. And that is the thing. And it's the fact that it's not just something he does because for riches or anything like that. As he demonstrates, he goes after Kitty because she's an easy target.
Lydia.
Sorry, not Kitty. Lydia, yes. He goes after Lydia because she's an easy target. He's not expecting any money from her. He's not going after her for marriage material. He's going after her for something else entirely.
Yeah, it's just the self-interested whim of the moment.
Yeah.
It's not for any other reason.
Exactly. And it's not love, either. It demonstratively isn't love either, because if it was love, he would have tried to have done it right, but he didn't.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so a couple, just two from me anyway, of the unromantic hero tropes again turn slightly on their head. There is an author, Emily Skrutsky, who has written several books, and they tend to be female romances.
Mm-hmm.
Or rather, that's what's in the books. They're generally speculative fiction. It's science fiction and fantasy. She's written a book called The Edge of the Abyss. And it's a world where sea monsters are kind of used as as assistance for transport and shipping. And you, your main character is someone who has trained her in Sea Monster from a very young age.
Okay.
She falls into, she gets trapped by pirates. Female pirate. This female pirate is kind of like the same rough sort of age bracket and exhibits the sort of alpha male type traits that you'd expect, except she's female, so it's turned it on its head.
Mm-hmm.
So all those people are kind of like would be fanning themselves over your typical paranormal romance with an alpha male.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a female-female romance doing it, and actually it's really nice the way it's done. It's great. So that's one. I feel a bit sort of bad Blue Moon trumpet here, and it's not really that I was writing romance, but when you think of, if you've read The King's Knight, Gregory
mm-hmm.
being sort of very much not a romantic hero in that he is a big brute of a man who is thoroughly scarred and almost 30, so definitely not in the age bracket for being a young romantic hero.
Yeah.
Not very good looking. And while he's very competent as a fighter, he has a lot of confidence issues when it comes to things like talking to women. Yeah. In fact, Gregory has zero game when it comes to talking to women. Particularly if he likes them and they're of his own class.
Yeah.
He's also dyslexic. And he feels very self-conscious of the fact that he might not actually be intelligent because of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, he's a great... I would totally agree that he is an atypical romantic hero. And that's probably, again, why I love him so much. Just in the same way that Cuthbert is an atypical romantic hero.
Oh, yeah.
Cuthbert's
a little sweetheart.
Why is it that I fall in love with all of the characters you write? Except Lucas. I never fell in love with Lucas.
I think you came to an accord with Lucas.
I came to an accord with Lucas because he was French and that's it.
It's probably because I actually write them for you, because you are my ideal. It's like, how can I test this for my target audience? Well, if Madeline likes them, it's probably about right.
Absolutely. Okay.
You was onto something when you fell for Steve.
Big tick there. So yes, I think that we've come to the logical conclusion.
Do you have any you want to add?
Well, I was going to mention, obviously, a big tick for Ron Weasley, who I said earlier. If you're looking at the old sort of anime kind of side of things, the show Naruto, which is very old now, so old in fact that there's a sequel show about Naruto's son, I'd have said Naruto was an atypical hero, whereas Sasuke was meant to be the kind of typical romantic hero that everyone fell in love with. And that
is this
explains...
where you say it's really old, but actually it was made in the 90s?
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Sorry.
Moving on.
But it's, yeah, I could never stand Sasuke because he was just a dick. Just couldn't understand any of that. So yeah, I think that you kind of get that as well. So I thought I'd mention those as well, that you can actually have the atypical romantic hero being the lead character. That is actually possible.
Yes.
As we've demonstrated, obviously, with Gregory as well. So there you go. Big tick. Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And Jules, I believe that you've got one for us.
Yes, unusually, I'm recommending a non-fiction book this week.
Ooh.
This is Ghostland by Edward Parnell. And it was, okay, admittedly, this book was clearly designed for me, for my target audience, me as a target audience member, rather.
Right.
But it's a beautiful meditation on grief, loss, and the importance of story.
Mm-hmm.
So basically what the author has said at the beginning is that he started to feel after losing his family,
mm-hmm.
you know, his entire early family unit of his mother, his father and his brother.
Mm-hmm.
There's only him left now. And oof. Someone in his family has basically been dying of cancer since his early teens. So, you know, a couple of years after his brother finally died of Hodgkin's lymphoma, then oof. he he was kind of thinking, I'm losing all the good memories. I'm losing all the things that made the family special. And I need to make some sort of reconnection with the places we visited and things. And he goes on this sort of self-imposed pilgrimage, both to places that he visited with his family as a child and as a young teenager, mm-hmm. and also to places that turned up in books that he read around that age, or, you know, the stories that saw him through the really difficult times.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of crossover in terms of sort of some of the TV shows, although he's sort of about 10 years older than me, so there's not quite as much crossover there, mm-hmm. but also with the books that we read. And these are almost exclusively ghost stories and folk horror stories. And the whole thing is just so beautifully woven together, and again with a reconnection with the land itself, as he goes around all these different places and sort of thinks back and uses them as prompts for the things that he did there with his brother and the time he and his mother were on a picnic and things. And it's incredibly moving, it's very poignant, and it's also very entertaining in terms of, you know, what stories tell us and what ghost stories tell us particularly. Mm. So I highly recommend that book, it was magnificent.
Fantastic, thank you very much. Well, on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening. Do get in contact with us. Let us know who your favourite unromantic heroes are. Do you disagree with the choices that we put forward? Do you feel as strongly about any of these characters as we do? Let us know. Remember, you can get in touch with us on Facebook or on Twitter individually, or on Tumblr individually, or as under the Dissecting Dragons handle. For now, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye!
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.